I'm not sure if you heard this, but I'd actually heard a month before Albemarle lobbed the bid, Gina and Albemarle were in cahoots and we're going to lob a bid for $3.20 for Liontown. That was one of the tipping points for me. Was like, the whole time I was looking at Capricorn going, oh, it looks expensive, looks expensive, looks expensive. And you just saw them deliver a project on time and on budget. For a project that had like 0.9 grams per tonne grade, when we first started looking at Mins, there was three analysts covering it despite it being a top 100 stock, and there was four different elements to the business. So people didn't invest the time, they didn't go, geez, this is how much the mining service business is actually worth, this is how much the lithium part of the business is worth. I'm not going to spend the time understanding the iron ore business. We'll just say that's going to make $0 in 2 years' time. And then what's this gas business? I'm just going to value that at zero. So we always get quizzed on ESG, right? For us, the most important letter in the ES and the G for us is governance. We ourselves can look at what has this management team done in the past? Are they aligned with us as shareholders? How much of the business do they own? Are they holders of the stock? Are they selling the stock?
G'day, money miners. Monday, 30th of October. We've got a cracking interview in store, don't we, Trev?
Wicked interview. A few bloody big announcements, but a wicked interview. I've had the privilege of being on the tools and doing the edit, so getting to listen to your wicked interview that you did with Mr. Anthony Kavanagh.
Yeah, so we'll share a bit about Anthony. He is the co-founder of Chester Asset Management. So they're a generalist fund. They've got a pretty cool strategy, which we dive into in a big way. So he started the fund with Rob Tucker back in 2017. So the two had previously worked at a Melbourne fund manager for about 4 years prior to that. And yeah, I mean, the strategy, the scope, their style of investing, it's all pretty cool. I found it pretty fascinating. We obviously have a big focus on materials, resources, and, you know, they've got a pretty cool way in which they allocate toward defensives, which is essentially gold and a portion of cash, which, you know, the interview was so chunky, we covered it in two parts, so there'll be a second part to this one, so I don't think I need to preamble any more than that.
I was amazed, like, listening to it, JD, and every time you asked a question, I felt like he answered about, like, five different things that you didn't ask that were so bloody interesting in each response. It was like, he was just unraveling insight throughout every response. It's kind of one that I think you need to play not at 1.5 speed but at 1 speed because he speaks that fast and you're trying to digest it all.
Mate, I've been moving back. I can't even do the 1.5 anymore. Actually digesting more information as it turns out when you slow down the speed, but you're dead right. And Anthony just, you know, exudes passion about equities, about investing, about markets. So it's, you know, in the room it was pretty powerful. It was good to hear his insights and pretty excited to share it with the money miners.
As wicked as part one is, I actually reckon part two is even better. That's just based on the like the company specific talk that you got to in part two. I reckon that was wicked. But mate, before we play part one, which is brilliant on a standalone basis, we've got a few big announcements to make about what we're going to be up to in the coming week, but also beyond the week. So start with, as soon as we bloody rip this ad and upload this episode, we are flying to Sydney for the IMARC conference. We're going to be there from Tuesday all the way. We're flying back on Friday and we'll be around. I think there's like we've got a little bit of a booth at IMARC. So come say good day if you're around the IMARC conference. Say hello to us. We're going to do our best to be able to chat and meet people, but also do some useful content as well.
That's it, mate. The cameras will be rolling. No guaranteeing that your chat gets on air. We'll be chopping it up and editing it afterwards. But, you know, if you're an investor, if you're running one of these companies, if you're in and around one of these companies, don't have to be running it, you know, come down, have a chat, tell us what you're thinking, tell us what the sort of, you know, the vibe of the market is and everything that you're hearing from your project, your commodity, anything like that, we're all ears.
More importantly, instead of saying g'day to us at the conference, although you should do that, come have a beer with us at 6 p.m. on Tuesday. So we're going to have a beer at the Criterion Hotel. So 6 p.m. Tuesday from 6 p.m. on Tuesday at the Criterion Hotel. You, myself, Maddie, we're all going to be there. We're going to hopefully have a bunch of money miners, people from across the bloody industry, all just talking about the stuff that we love all the time. So
that's tomorrow, guys, October 31. Come down, have a beer, have a chat.
I got another big announcement, JD. So I saw Ali launch this today, which is pretty damn exciting. So Ali has posted on social medias that we're having our first ever live event. So this is different from the meetup, which we're going to have on Tuesday, a separate thing. We're actually going to do a proper live show in December at a pub that can sort of fit, you know, a few hundred people, which is wicked. So this is going to be, the actual event is going to be on Thursday, the 7th of December at Golden West Brewery at 5 p.m.
So I'm pumped. And like a big, big shout out to Ali G. She has put together a, you know, phenomenal effort. The effort she's gone into to tee up this event. It's going to be awesome. There's going to be a bit of a live show. We've got something in the works.
Mm-hmm.
A couple hundred money miners in there. Again, just have a drink, have a chat, get to know each other. I'm pretty pumped for it, mate.
Yeah, like 100%. There's going to be people from across the spectrum. Our audience cuts across the spectrum of people. It's not like just targeted at retail people. There's like really, you know, serious savvy people who listen to our show who are gonna come down. So have a yarn, meet some interesting people, because they're all gonna hopefully be there. The interesting point for the astute money miner to pay attention to, JD, is the fact that tickets launch at 10 a.m. this Thursday. So that's 10 a.m. this Thursday. What is Thursday? It's like 2nd of November?
The 2nd of November.
2nd of November, 10 a.m. They go live on Megatix. We'll put a link in the bio. There's also a link in the social media post floating about. But, you know, we're confident this is going to be a sellout event. So, buddy, make sure you get in there, buy yourself a bloody ticket and lock it in. And then when everyone's sort of in that season in December where everyone's gone to Christmas parties, this is the event to go to.
Yeah, and it's not just like one of those, you know, legacy conferences, mate. There's going to be an open bar. There's going to be food and stuff. We're not charging you $1,000 to come down.
No, it's so pretty reasonable. Yeah.
A couple hundred people, I think, is what the max capacity of the place is. So just come down and just have a good, you know, evening in the December summertime in Perth. Yeah, just in Subiaco.
Wicked. Now, I've got my last big announcement, JD. We bloody had a wicked new sponsor come on Friday's episode. That was KCA. Well, we've got three more new sponsors to introduce this week, which I'm goddamn excited about.
Some really cool companies we're teaming up with.
It is wicked to have, you know, to be able to talk about the really interesting and good companies that are providing like diverse services to the industry that we love. And the one that we get to talk about today, mate, I'm pumped to be aligning with them and having a chat with them was just, it filled me with bloody energy. So the company, mate, we are talking about today is Future Proof Consulting. This is a fascinating company, mate. They cover the spectrum of sustainability consulting. This is important for the companies that we talk about on a bloody regular basis for a bunch of reasons. We just spoke with Ben Swan, who runs Future Proof, mate, and I'm keen to get your bloody big takeaways from that chat.
Mate, well, it's a great precursor leading into the interview we're doing today because Anthony speaks about, you know, in his words, that the G in ESG being vital. We speak about it all the time. You know, the governance is a big issue that we pick upon. You know, sustainable mining, all these things are critically vital for the businesses that we talk about. And for them to be, you know, enduring successful businesses, they need to go about it in the right way. And Ben Swan, like you touched on, at Future Proof, he runs this business targeting these companies that have projects. They're in that sort of study phase. They're, you know, becoming ingrained in a community and they want to go about it in the right way. They want to be there for the long haul. They want to do it, you know, they want to build a sustainable business.
Mm-hmm.
Get in touch with Ben and he can, you know, he's done it before. He's worked with smaller companies all the way right up to, you know, your evolutions of the world. He can help you out along the way.
Big time. I took a bloody lot away from our conversation with Ben. One was the fact that they work with companies including Remelius, Regis, Capricorn, De Grey, Red 5, Talison Lithium, Global Lithium. They used to work with Mincor.
The piece on the battery metals was fascinating to hear, right?
Fascinating. So in a crux, like what is a sustainability consultant going to help you to do? They're going to help you to basically formulate a strategy to, you know, have reach your sustainability kind of goals, so you're more appealing as a company, but doing the right thing as well. But it's a nuanced outlook on it. I love the fact that Ben said ESG ratings are bullshit.
100%.
And we agree, but we do think it's bloody important to be a miner in a responsible way and do it in a sustainable way. And that's like helping to formulate that and helping to deliver on that actually makes you more attractive as a company from a capital flows perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And another example would be, you know, the battery element companies wanting to get access to the OEMs of the world and so on. It was interesting to hear that those companies, those OEMs, whether that's, you know, your Fords of the world, your Volkswagens of the world, they'll be sussing out the ins and outs of your particular mining project, your company, and they'll go straight to the group like Future Proof and to, you know, really get to the crux of the issue. Is it going to be a brand that they want to align with? So
get your act together. If you haven't gotten Future Proof on your side yet, buddy, get them involved because they're going to be super important to how you position your company from an investor standpoint, from a sustainability standpoint, and just like, buddy, everything.
That's it. Pick up the phone, give Ben Swan a call at Future Proof, and thanks a lot for sponsoring us, guys.
All right, mate, to the interview.
Let's rip it. Today, here with me, I've got Anthony Kavanagh. Anthony has started Chester Asset Management back in 2017 with a former colleague of his, Rob Tucker. So Chester, as we'll get into, focuses more broadly than just the resource sector, but as I'm sure you're all going to hear in the next hour or so, Anthony's got quite the passion. So Anthony, thanks for coming on Money of Mine.
Thank you very much for having me on, mate. It's a great experience and I'm pretty excited to be talking stocks with you today.
I'm really excited. And there's something I wanted to clear up straight away. I've been doing a bit of diving into Chester for the interview. And I know you're a football fan. I know you're an Arsenal fan. And every time I see the Chester logo, I am seeing the Chelsea emblem. Is there something to this or is this purely coincidence?
It was a complete mistake of mine to let it pass. It was actually Rob's wife that was in charge of helping design our company logo. So shout out to Michelle. We really appreciate it. But correct. After we developed the logo, I don't know if it was subliminal the fact that it was CHE with Chelsea, CHE Chester, but it does look strikingly similar. And I only figured that out after someone else notified me. And I was dismayed as an Arsenal fan. I was ready to pack it all in and throw away the logo and replace it with something else. But it is kind of resemblant of regalness and the strength of a lion. So there is some symbolism there. If you don't know the story, Chester was actually Rob's granddad's name. He was the person who introduced Rob into stock. So we thought we'd name the company after someone who had an enormous amount of passion. And Rob, you know, greatly admired the work ethic of his grandfather. And it's kind of, I guess, symbolic of what we try and represent at Chester. Just that unwavering work ethic and desire to find the right companies to invest in.
Alrighty, I'll let you off for that one then because there's a good story behind it, mate. Let's get into the strategy behind Chester. And you fleshed it out to me in the past and on your website you go into detail. You ran the strategy for a few years before starting Chester and there's a sort of split across predictables, cyclicals and defensives. It sort of tends to, from what I can sort of surmise, have a balance of 60%, 25% roughly and 15%. Can you get into how you came about this strategy and specifically how you find those allocations? Have they sort of been a factor of, you know, trying to find the right balance and stuff? Are you setting your ways with them?
Well, it is somewhat stringent. I mean, I think it's born out of our history in markets and mainly my colleague Rob's history in markets, just trying to find, as you said, the right balance between how you're going to generate a predictable level of return and how you're going to generate alpha. And also the number one lesson for us is protecting capital. So if we think about, as you said, predictable cyclicals and defensives, I'll start at the top with defensives. Now, defensives is probably the most unique aspect of what we do at Chester. And a lot of people in markets, we've spoken about things being polarizing. I'd say one of the most polarizing trends or trades is gold and gold equities. So for us, we believe in gold and we believe in gold equities. And that defensive part of the portfolio, that 10%, for us, it's kind of like an insurance mechanism. But we also believe we can find the right gold stocks. So what do I mean by that? If you look at the history of gold during down markets, so in down markets, we've looked at the history since, I guess, World War II. So the last, let's call it 100 years, when the markets, and we're talking the US market, when the market is down more than 15%, on average, gold outperforms quite materially. So we've looked at those time periods, and the times the markets are down 15% or more, they're actually down 35% on average, and there's been about 15 or 16 time periods when it's occurred. And during those time periods, gold as an asset class is up 8%. So that's 43% outperformance of gold during down markets. And you think of the ballast that provides when there's those periods of drawdown, for us, holding gold equities provides kind of that insurance mechanism and enables us to kind of generate, I guess, some positive returns, hopefully, when the market has that drawdown period. And if we think back to, I guess, March 2020, that's the most recent example of when we had a big drawdown period. The market, or at least the index we look at, the ASX 300, was down 21% during that month. And the gold stocks in our portfolio stood us in good stead, and we underperformed, we didn't underperform. We actually only dropped 16% during that time. So we outperformed the market by 5%, and it was the gold stocks that were the ones that were the outperformers during that period. Now, we don't go through our peers or our competitors and look at what they're doing, but we were aware that a number of other funds in the market, some of the, I guess, higher growth funds that don't necessarily invest in gold and don't necessarily invest in commodities, some of those funds were down 25 and 30% over that time period. And so it goes to the heart of what we're trying to do, is we're trying to protect capital initially and then try and make money while we're doing so. So I was talking about defensives. That's between 5 and 10% of the portfolio in gold, and then up to 20% in defensive. So we can also hold cash, which is basically for us the opportunity cost to invest in something when we see the opportunity to arise. We like to hold around 5% in cash as well as that 5 or 10% in gold. The cyclicals, it's up to 25% of the portfolio. So as you said, around 20% is probably a good number. And for us, that's mainly commodities, but can also be kind of building materials and retail companies, anything that we define as cyclical. And as you rightly pointed out, the predictables is around 65% of the portfolio, but 60% is a pretty good number. And for us, we're literally looking for what we can define as the best quality businesses at the right prices. So if we think about a portfolio with those three different buckets, it's almost like we've got two distinct strategies kind of working in unison, almost synergistically. And the gold and the cyclicals, it's very much a valuation-driven decision. So the first thing we're looking to do, because those cash flows are driven by a commodity price, whether it be gold, whether it be oil, whether it be, you know, building material companies that are subject to a cycle, those cash flows we define as inherently uncertain. So we want to have a large enough margin of safety in taking that position. So for us, the cyclicals and defensives, we are predominantly driven by a valuation argument first, and then we need to satisfy one of two other criteria. So that criteria is quality, whether it be the quality of the asset, quality of the management team, quality of that business, and then also edge. Do we have an edge or an insight that the market is mispricing the earnings of that business? Do we see something within that business or its earnings profile that the market is missing? And the most obvious is you come and you do your model on a company and the earnings of that business are 100% higher than consensus. Now, 100% is an extreme example, and it's not always 100%, but do you see something within those earnings that the market is missing? Hence, there could be a catalyst event for that to get unlocked, where it leads to a re-rate, or at least the market then catches up with your view on that company or that business. So that's basically the strategy in the nutshell, as simple as I can make it, I guess.
So you touched on the various sort of percentages between materials and gold combined can sit between 20, 25% from over the periods on average. I'm keen to hear how this sort of plays across commodity cycles. The way I sort of think about it is when commodity companies, equities get cheaper, to stay within your balance, you're actually allowed to buy more. And then as the equities rise, do you find it sort of tends to help you out in being counter-cyclical as an investor in the commodity space because you start trimming as the valuations grow and vice versa? Do you think about it in that regard at all?
I wouldn't say that we do. We're not managing to say we have to have exactly 25% in cyclicals any one time. So it is a good point that we definitely do try to be counter-cyclical, but it's not necessarily driven by the fact that we're trying to keep it at 25%. What I would say is we're trying to avoid the macro as much as we can. Like, we love thinking about the macro and how it might influence the portfolio, but sometimes it can be almost counterintuitive to think too much about the macro. Like, if you'd asked me 12 months ago how the macro was going to unfold over the next 12 months, I would have said that we're about to enter recession, everyone's staffed, house prices are going to go backwards, no one's going to spend any money, no one's certainly going to travel, right? And you look forward 12 months after that fact and what's happened is YOLO has taken hold and everyone's going nuts and going to Bali and going to Europe and spending as much money as they possibly can. So what we're trying to do by having 65% in predictables, up to 25% in cyclicals and that kind of position in gold and defensives is just basically remove kind of the bias to move towards a certain weighting in, you know, lithium when lithium's running or, you know, like infant formula when infant formula trade is on, and just try and remove those biases and try and be as diversified as possible within guardrails. And I think it stands us in good stead during certain periods, and the periods where we've probably underperformed the most has been when we've been too focused on the macro and sometimes almost slightly wavered from those guardrails that we have in place.
And then, of course, getting into the cyclicals there, one of the, in commodities specifically, one of the key differences between the predictables is that some of them are developers, so there's no cash flows to speak of at all. How do you sort of break down your allocations within materials between, you know, pre-revenue and actually cash flow producing businesses?
Yeah, so the pyramid that we spoke to was 65% in predictables, 25% in cyclicals, and the rest in defensives. That's kind of real stringent. We try and, like, we make sure that we're never going 25% above cyclicals. We're never going above the certain amount we have in gold. We do have a more open-ended kind of, I guess, allocation between growth stocks, mature stocks, and emerging at the start. So we try and keep the emerging names up to a maximum of 15% of the portfolio. And then the growth stocks can be anywhere from like 30% up to 50%, and mature companies the rest. Now, it's not a hard and fast rule, but those emerging companies, we really try and limit the amount of exposure we have in that part of the market. Because it's not necessarily our skill set to go on and hunt for, you know, exploration companies or companies that are pre-development. I mean, I'll leave that to the geologists amongst us. But, I mean, we're sometimes good at identifying opportunities that the rest of the market might miss because we invest the time in actually looking at the detail, reading, I guess, reports, you know, and even competitors' feasibility studies and understanding why the cost structure of one company might differ to another, or the management team behind a certain company, why they might, you know, develop a project better than someone else might, or how they're incentivized to get that project on stream. So, yeah, I guess we try and play to our competitive advantage in that regard.
From our conversations, I've picked up on a real sort of need from you to be contrarian. And I'm very interested to hear how it sort of manifests in your investment process. Do you go out and look for, you know, sectors or companies that other people are beating up upon, or how does it actually sort of play a role in the investment process for you?
It doesn't necessarily lead us down into certain sectors or themes where other people aren't necessarily playing, but it certainly helps when we're screening, we're thinking about stocks, to be thinking in a contrarian mindset. I mean, some of the best opportunities that we've made money on is when stocks are unloved or underappreciated, but we can see something unique in that asset or the company or the management team where others in the market might not necessarily have seen it. So it's definitely not a prerequisite to target contrarian investments, but often when we find them, that's where we can get the most excited. We've got a couple of companies at the moment, and not necessarily even in the mining space, but there's one in particular I'm thinking of, a shipbuilder, and we're going to meetings at the moment where we're literally the only fund attending these meetings. There might be one other. And this company has net cash. Its earnings projections to us suggest it's trading on 3x EBIT 2 to 3 years forward. Global peers trade on 10 to 12 times EBIT. And the remuneration report, the LTIs, are structured in such a way that if they achieve 10% ROE, which is the bottom end of their LTI targets, they should deliver an NPAT figure of $95 million average over 3 years. Now, they've already put out guidance for financial year 24, and it equates to about $40 million. So 25 and 26, by, you know, the maths of $95 million average over 3 years, would need to equal $125 million in 25 and 26 for them to hit the bottom end of their LTI target. Now, the market for this company is at $60 and $70 million. So for this company, and it's Austal, and I know it's not a mining company, but for this company to hit the bottom end of its LTI targets would literally need to deliver a figure 100% above consensus for that to be triggered. Now, I've asked a few people in the market why we're the only people that care about it, and a few people respond that they haven't hit their numbers in the past, no one believes their LTIs, how do you have any confidence that the margins are how they are? And we've spoken to a number of people in the market, including ex-shipbuilders, ex-employees, the board, the management team, and even in their annual reports, it specifically says that the LTIs, or the base of their LTIs, the board considers it 50 to 60% probable that they'll be met. So the board is literally saying to us, we think it's more likely than not that they hit the bottom end of their LTI targets, and the market is just saying BS. We don't believe it. We don't see how that can be possible. And for us, that's kind of, it's an insight, right? We've done the work from a bottom-up perspective to go, if they build these ships, their revenue will be 2.7 based on historic margins, what everyone else in the market is earning on other Navy ships. it equates to 180 million EBIT. The bottom end of their LTI of $125 million, if you normalise it 30% tax, it should equate to 180 million EBIT, whereas the market just doesn't believe it and is not prepared to give them the benefit of that number. And we're like, well, okay, it's a pretty big upside, right? Your downside is capped in the fact that their book value is $2.62 and they're currently trading at $1.72. So you're trading at 70% of its book value. And there were five private equity firms that bid for this company, were reported to be interested in bidding for this company 3-4 months ago, but they stuffed up one contract and the whole market just extrapolates the here and the now. And I think that's a very relevant point in mining, is that, you know, there's plenty of companies that they have one bad quarter or something doesn't look great when you start up a mine, but, you know, the McNulty curve or that, you know, startup curve means that there is a lot of learnings that go on whenever you start a project, whenever you start a mine. And if you kind of think past the here and the now as to what that could look like 12, 18, 24 months down the track, sometimes it can create real great opportunities when others just think in the here and the now. So that's, I know I went on a long tangent when you just asked me about Couture and trades, but like, you get me excited when you start talking about a company where...
You've given me plenty of tangents to go down myself.
Yeah.
So I want to pick out a few threads from what you just said there.
Yep.
The first one is, how does that sort of tie into how you then go and size a position?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So you've got the, you know, cap downside in this case, as you see it, and, a high risk reward payoff, I guess. How does that sort of play into you sizing? You got, you know, nobody else liking the thing.
Yeah.
What's the outcome?
Well, I said no one else liking. You'd probably prefer to have one or two people liking it, because then at least you got someone else buying a stock with you.
Not the only one who's crazy.
Yeah, no, that's right. The sizing will differ. Firstly, the first thing I'd say is the size of the company can help, and the liquidity can help to frame how you think about sizing. So our large caps, if it's an unbelievable high conviction trade, might be a 6% position. The absolute max we've ever been to is an 8% position. If it's a small cap, it's generally a 2% position as kind of like a base level. And then if it's a really high conviction idea, it can get to a 4% position. The company I just referred to is probably getting close to the upper end of that range. But if you see the situation where your downside is very much capped in your mind, when something's trading at 70% of book value, and it's net cash as well, because net cash is a big thing, because something can be a certain percentage of book value because they've got a lot of debt, it can actually be a quite risky position. We kind of see it as kind of the downside being protected. So it's a good point that if you can see the situation like we can see there, where if they actually get these margins right, like historically when they've stuffed up previous margins and 3-4 years down the track, they're at 7-8% margins again. If they get those margins right and it can get to 100, even 130, 140 million EBIT and trade on, you know, 3.5-4 times EBIT when the rest of the global shipbuilders trade on 10 times EBIT, it's a pretty high conviction idea for us. So it's a function of just that downside protection, but it's also a function of those three balls. If I can satisfy all three balls and have material upside to my valuation, then it becomes a higher conviction idea than otherwise. If you've satisfied, so we need to satisfy two of those balls. The higher you think that they can beat market's expectations from an earnings perspective, the higher the insight level, the higher the upside to your valuation, and the higher the quality of the business gives the higher weight that it'll get in the portfolio.
And then, so you gave the caps, say, in the large cap example, a maximum of 8%. How does that sort of play into you selling the positions once your thesis is playing out correct? It'll hit that 8% and that'll force you to start letting some go?
But if you think about those three balls and the reasons why you invest in the stock, so you need to satisfy two of those balls. If any of those balls disappear, then you're likely to sell the stock. So the most obvious is valuation, right? So those cyclical and defensive positions that we make, if the stock gets close to our valuation, that's the key ball that's gone and we sell it, right? So if you've read any of the stuff that I put out there on Livewire around mins, we've actually been really religious about trimming our mins position when it gets towards our valuation. Like the second note that we put out, can MinRes be a $40 stock? When it got there, we actually reduced our position, because despite us thinking it's a high quality business and we had insight, our valuation ball was satisfied and that's the main ball we look at. So we actually trimmed that position. And then it came off and we reassessed when the lithium prices changed and market view on lithium spodumene prices and hydroxide prices changed. We then came out with an updated valuation that was $66, life after 40 time to go overseas, and MinRes got up to 63. So a similar story there, we trimmed our position. So when one of those balls is satisfied and you're only left with one ball, you don't want to be holding that one ball. We kind of go, well, all right, now's a good time to reassess and trim our position. And if the facts change, you have to change your mind, right? Like if the thesis is that you think there's material upside to that valuation and it doesn't work out, you've got to change your position. You've got to change your mind. And Austell could be a good example of that. Like, if we get confirmation that those two contracts they entered into, which supports our thesis that this thing could be worth more than $4 on Australian dollar 70, if we get some level of insight that, you know, they've bid on the OPC contract at a very slim margin and they've overcooked their labour cost expectations and it's actually been a lot higher because of inflation, or something around the Tiago's contract doesn't quite feel right after we speak to some people in the market, then maybe we reduce our conviction on the stock. But at this point in time, we've still got high conviction on each of those different tenets of the thesis.
One of the other factors you pointed to there was the LTIs and incentives, and, you know, corporate governance is something on Money of Mine we speak about all the time. It's sort of critical to how we think about companies. And obviously the same goes for you. You've written some Livewire articles on insiders, directors, trading and all this sort of stuff. So to start with, how do you think about getting alignment between management and shareholders? Now, how sort of bigger checkbox is this in your checklist to invest in a company?
So we always get quizzed on ESG, right? And then people go, well, you invest in oil and gas companies, you invest in a gaming stock. For us, the most important letter in the E, S and the G for us is governance. Now, I can't convince a company to, you know, buy carbon credits or, you know, invest in the rainforest or plant trees. In fact, we had a company that was planting trees that ended up being one of our worst investments. But we can satisfy the G criteria. So we ourselves can look at what has this management team done in the past? Are they aligned with us as shareholders? How much of the business do they own? Are they holders of the stock? Are they selling the stock? So their track record, the independence of the board and the caliber of the members on the board and what they've achieved in the past is probably the greatest criterion in ESG as to what we look at. And as you said, buying and selling shares we use as kind of like, it's not necessarily a flag to go, we have to sell the stock, but it's a really good kind of thing to check in on when there's a director selling as to why we still have comfort or why we still have conviction on that stock. Now, if you've read some of the notes we put out there, directors can sell for one of 100 reasons, right? But you're only buying for one reason. So I feel like the signal of a director buying a material position in a company has a greater weight of signal than what one director selling one individual stock has. If two directors start selling a stock, that's when it starts to tick off a few alarm bells. If one director sells a material amount of stock, it can tick off alarm bells. So it's, you never have perfect information as a shareholder, and that's one of the things you get as a market participant. You never know 100% exactly what's going on, but the people closest to the information, the directors, the management, the board, any indication that they've got, whether it be the LTI structure or whether it be an intangibles note within the accounts or whether it is buying or selling stock, gives you that extra little bit of insight into how they're thinking about the business that we don't otherwise have. So it is a very important factor for us. We like to invest with guys who have skin in the game. So we're more likely to invest in founder-led businesses where we can, particularly when management owns a fair chunk of stakes. So if you look at our mining companies that we're invested in at the moment, like MinRes is our number one mining position, but we've also got a position in Develop and Genesis because we love how Bill is highly aligned to us as shareholders. We love that Rao and the team at Genesis have got their own skin in the game at that company. And we feel that the way we act with our money and how we allocate capital is exactly how we want to invest the capital. Like, we're big shareholders in our own funds. Like, the majority of my super money goes into our fund, and any spare discretionary money I have is invested in the fund.
Do you think it's underrated, people watching, you know, checking in on directors and stuff? Is it something that flies a bit too much under the radar still?
Oh, I think it's getting more and more prominence. I think it has to. Like, if you think about the way the market is going with ESG, you're often now finding that a lot of the large investment houses do have someone specifically dedicated to ESG. So I think there is necessarily someone there who is doing a lot of the work around governance, but is the right hand talking to the left hand? I don't know, but I think it is. I wouldn't say it's something that is not being thought about, but I think following the right management teams is something that, like, when I first started my career, it was something that I didn't appreciate as much as I do now, if that makes sense. Like, before, when I was looking at mining projects, it would just be, which of these projects has the highest NPV? That's the one I'm going to go for. And almost to the ignorance of every other aspect of that project, you know, when you're comparing different companies. And that's probably led to me personally making certain mistakes with whether it's Sire Resources or whether it be even Jervois. Sometimes you can get too hung up on what the model is telling you from a valuation perspective. But if you follow the right management teams, the level of comfort you have as a shareholder even if your MPV isn't quite as high an upside, that MPV is more likely to get realised if someone has done it before and they know how to deliver on those types of projects. So, you know, hence why portfolio might hold a MinRes and a Develop and a Genesis now versus some of the companies I might have held previously when I was a bit more of an immature investor.
Yeah, and I think to your point, it's like over the past 5 years, the evidence has been astounding. You know, Mark Clark is another example of Capricorn. The teams that have done it before have an outstanding track record over the past 5 years or so.
And I think that was one of the example of Capricorn you just gave, that was one of the tipping points for me. Was like the whole time I was looking at Capricorn going, oh, it looks expensive, looks expensive, looks expensive. And you just saw them deliver a project on time and on budget. And for a project that had like 0.9 grams per tonne grade, you just went, how are they going to make
in the same period that they did it, built the project, inflationary period,
COVID too, right? So yeah, hats off to Clark and the team there. And that kind of, I think I wrote a paper maybe 2 years ago when I was talking about insiders, and we coined the term book club deal. And I think at the time I was going, well, I'm looking at VentureX, which is now developed, I'm looking at Genesis, and they had this big pop, and you just thought, oh, no, I'll wait for it and I'm not going to chase it now. And the same thing happened with Capricorn, and it never looked back after that initial pop when Mark Clark came into the Karlawinda project. And we've since kind of revisited how we think about those companies, and hence why we've now got Develop and Genesis in the portfolio. I mean, they came back to a more realistic valuation, and both Bill and Raoul have kind of backfilled the valuation by adding on, you know, elements of their projects or taking on new projects that you can then justify the valuation to underpin them. But yeah, I think it's a really important lesson to follow the right management teams that can deliver that have done in the past.
Yeah, and I really like the iterative process to your investment process as well. You know, you keep learning. You've touched on a few sort of Buffettisms or Mungerisms throughout, and I want to touch on your circle of competence. You had experiences in audit starting early in your career, then as an energy analyst as well.
Correct.
And I'm always intrigued when we talk with more generalist fund managers, given that you spread across various sectors. You're looking at pharmaceutical companies, resources companies, mining services, shipbuilding companies. How do you think about your circle of competence and the sectors? Are there sectors you won't touch, for example?
Well, there's certainly some sectors that I just kind of open them up and I think I'm reading French. And I think we had one example today. I said to my colleague in the office, I go, I just didn't understand it. It was a biotech company, by the way. And, you know, I would say that I'm not necessarily up the curve on biotech, but I certainly love to learn. So healthcare is certainly an area I've been like trying to invest some time into. But it's a good point that your circle of competence, I think that's where you end up making the most amount of money. Like, it was one of those things when I first got into funds management after being an energy analyst. It was almost my fear was reverting to energy and just like focusing on energy, because I didn't want to be one of those people who just, that's my circle of confidence, that's all I'm going to focus on. So I've always like pushed myself to learn other sectors. But at the same time, you can't ignore where you do have a competitive edge, where you do have that advantage, because that's inevitably where you probably will find it easier to make money, if that makes sense. So my fear was, you know, if I become a portfolio manager, I'm going to end up with this portfolio full of energy stocks, because that's where I started my career. Do you know what I mean? And I've been really conscious trying to avoid that bias. But at the same time, at certain times when certain sectors are doing well, sometimes it pays to pay attention to that competitive advantage that you've got. But to the point of competitive advantages, I know you had Rick and Karina on here last week, and I listened to what they had to say. And like, Rick's a gun, Karina's a gun. Like, I love those different viewpoints in markets, because I'm certainly not a geologist. So I can't pick up, you know, the results of Azure and go, that's going to be 150 million tonne ore body at 1.5% and that's going to be XYZ. There's people in markets like Rick and Karina that are unbelievable doing that. And, you know, I've spoken about my mate John Denise, and he's really good at identifying those early opportunities and like riding those, you know, when they go from a discovery into that, when they go through that discovery phase and other people start to understand them. I think our skill set and how I kind of view markets is kind of almost understanding the economics of getting something that has become a discovery into a project, and also kind of peeling apart sometimes companies that others might find complex. And I know, you know, you ventured into Buffett and Charlie Munger territory, and they'll tell you not to invest in something you don't understand. But there's sometimes companies that are complex, but they're easy to understand. It's just that they're not a simple, like, take the example of Pilbara, for example. It's a simple open pit that anyone who doesn't even understand mining can understand, right? Like, you've got a strip ratio, you've got a grade, you know what ore is going to come out. That's your model. You know, it's a single mine. It's pretty easy to understand. When we first started looking at Mins, there was three analysts covering it despite it being a top 100 stock, and there was four different elements to the business. And so people didn't invest the time. They didn't go, geez, this is how much the mining service business is actually worth. This is how much the lithium part of the business is worth. I'm not going to spend the time understanding the iron ore business. We'll just say that's going to make $0 in 2 years' time and leave it at that. And then what's this gas business? I'm just going to value that at zero. Do you know what I mean? So like me having that multifaceted exposure has actually benefited us in some ways in the mining space by being able to go, hang on a sec, I know how to look at the contractors. I've looked at IMDEX, you know, I've looked at Perenti, and I can understand how people think about mining service businesses. And I can use that knowledge to then go, well, what do I think MIN's mining service business is actually worth if I take that type of viewpoint? What do I think the lithium business is worth based on all the analogues from Pilbara's Pilgangoora project? Because, you know, 4 years ago, MIN's might not necessarily had as much information out there as what they do around the lithium business, certainly not 6 or 7 years ago when they first acquired Wodgina. And so people didn't necessarily understand it. And if they don't understand it, they're not going to be able to value it, right? So, but having looked at, you know, in detail, those single mine companies that put out the feasibility studies like Pilbara, that put out the cost structure, you can then go, well, how is Wodgina going to differ to Pilgangoora? And what does that mean for how much Wodgina is actually worth to MINs? What do I believe that, you know, the gas resource could actually be worth for mineral resources? Because that's another part now that the market's going, we don't think it's worth much. And I'm going, well, it could be worth a couple of billion dollars. And the same thing with their mining service business was that people were thinking, you know, this mining service business might be worth, you know, a couple of billion dollars, but valuing it with like a 4x EBITDA and earnings going backwards. And I'm like, you just need to look at their internal projects and what tenders are out there to know that it could double over a 3 to 5 year period and need to put a higher multiple on it. And I keep going off on different tangents, but I'm trying to throw in their examples about how like our experiences being generalists but also having that niche knowledge on one specific sector can combine to give you a bit more of a holistic view on a company that's a little bit more complex than just a simple mining story.
Before we go even deeper on the company specific, I want to sort of frame it in terms of the macro, especially given how vital that is to commodities. So China's been in the news plenty lately for housing, for demographic challenges that it's facing. And there was a comment in the most recent Chester Quarterly to the effect of how do we have a unique insight into China, given, you know, we're sitting here in Melbourne, it's, you know, far away, complex. That said, what is your sort of thesis around China? How do you think about how China progresses for the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, I'll say that my colleague Rob spent a lot of time in China during his formative years in funds management. Like, he used to work at HSBC out of the Hong Kong office. And I'm going to misquote the number of times he spent in China over a two-year period, but I think it was something like 61 times he went up and saw different mine sites in China. So I come up with that point of view. And during that time, I would say that Rob's previously described himself as a commodities bull. He could see the change that was taking place in the urbanisation of China and saw what benefit that could provide to the iron ore companies of Australia, whether it be FMG or BHP. I'd say today we're sitting here quite negative on China. And part of the reason is that we're part of the way through that urbanisation strategy, so for want of a better term, and 16% of the world's population in China is consuming 53% of the world's steel. So our viewpoint is that at some point in the future, and maybe it's not next year or maybe it's not 5 years' time, there's going to come a point where people realise, or at least China might realise, that they've been overproducing the amount of steel that they actually need and they don't actually need that much steel going forward. Now, one of the key underpins behind that thesis is the demographics of China. Now, I'll try and explain it, and I used to have the exact stats off the top of my head, but if you look at what China has been historically, during the 1950s, they changed a whole bunch of their policies around law, around the land to which people owned and started this urbanisation push. And it meant that a lot of farmland actually got taken off the hands of the farmers. And so you actually saw, I think it was called the Great Chinese Famine. I'm not a historian. I just know bits and pieces. And that famine led to the deaths of quite a number of infants and young people in China. They just didn't have enough food to feed the population. And that then led to this massive amount of overbreeding, right? So you're trying to replace the people that you've lost. And so the Chinese population, my understanding is, it absolutely boomed during like the 60s and the 70s, right? And that's created this overpopulation situation. So then they've gone the other way, and they've created the one-child policy to overcompensate from that overbreeding. So this kind of cyclicality of, like, you know, deaths into overbreeding into single-child policy has created this real distorted demographic position for them. similar to the baby boomer generation, but on steroids. So if you think that they've only allowed one child in the population, and I can't remember the exact dates of when the one-child policy was enacted, I think it was the early 80s, you've basically had one child per family from the 80s into the 2000s during a period where you've got this massive amount of population that's about to hit retirement age. So the dependency ratio completely flips in the next 10 to 20 years in China. So, and I'm gonna make up numbers here. We should really check this after the chat. But I think you go from something like four workers to one dependent to almost like two workers to one dependent or something like that, right? And you can just kind of visualize what impact that's going to have on markets and in China, right? Who are the people that buy houses? It's the workers, you know. Who are the people that provide the money that then kind of goes to pay pensions or whatever? It's the workers. So that massive shift in the demographic in China, we just think is going to have like huge consequences for the Chinese population, huge consequences for the iron ore market. So if there's one commodity that we're not constructive on a 10 to 20 year view, and maybe that's too far out for the market to even care, it's iron ore. Like we do see the supply coming. That demand shift is going to be quite material. So it's just one of those commodities that we're just going, look, we just don't need to be owning iron ore. And for us, I know a lot of the other fund managers in the market are very focused on what the index is. And, you know, you just need to look at BHP, Rio and Fortescue, and it's a large component of the index. I would say 15% of the index. I don't know that number off the top of my head. But, you know, and to not have any exposure to iron ore means there's 15% of the index that we're not really that enamored with. And that capital is going to other sectors like, you know, the lithium space, or, you know, our position in gold might compensate for some of it. So
a lot of people that, you know, maybe bullish iron ore or maybe bullish development across the globe will sort of, you know, replace that with India, and they say India is going to be the sort of growth one. Do you buy into that thesis?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in India. I don't think it's going to be the same urbanisation that we saw with China. There's a lot of differences in the Indian or politics and the infrastructure that they've got versus China, and it's beyond my pay grade to actually be able to point out the two differences. But I do think we've now seen the switch in China being the number one population on earth to it being India. Now, it's a small stat, and I don't think it's hugely relevant at this point. But, and again, I'm going to try and kind of quote numbers, but I'm going to be wildly off the mark. But from my understanding, you go back 30 years ago and India was almost on par with China from a GDP per capita perspective. And today I'm pretty sure that China is almost four times GDP per capita of what India is over that same time period. So China has experienced immense growth and India's kind of been left on the wayside. But we are starting to see kind of, I guess the politics has started to go somewhat in the right direction, and India is starting to see possibly a stronger level of growth. I mean, China got to the limits of where it can possibly get to. And we start, some of the developers in China starting to roll over. You start to wonder as to when is going to be the pinch point that China actually sees this Japanese moment, if you understand the analogy between what happened with Japan 20, 30 years ago. The 89 situation. But India, if there's one economy that would say that we think is probably going to grow faster than most of the rest of the world, it's India. But then you go, well, how are you actually going to get exposure to that from an Australian perspective? And sitting here today, I said how we're somewhat negative towards iron ore. I would say almost the opposite to coal from a demographic point of view. Obviously, you know, there's still the ESG considerations around thermal coal. But if you think about India, like India has its own incumbent source of iron ore in country. Unlike, you know, I mean, China does have its own, but I would say that India is almost self-sustaining in iron ore, but they don't have coal. A lot of their coal actually comes from Indonesia, but it's a lot of low-grade Indonesian stuff. Over the next 20 years, I would say India, met coal to India might be what iron ore is to China, but we just don't have as big an exposure to that. You know, you look at Queensland and there's not a huge amount of mines. And I think Whitehaven are seeing that and kind of going, well, thermal might become, you know, this, it almost has become the cigarette, you know, company of the mining world. If we can transition to become more of a metallurgical coal company than just pure thermal, that's going to provide us benefits in a re-rate and also give us longevity into the future, whereas thermal, you know, you look at different estimates, it might be gone in 20 years.
And perhaps BHP are actually seeing that, given that they're holding on to, I think, four off the top of my head of the highest quality coking coal projects in the Bowen Basin in the world, really. So maybe they're sort of preempting that.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a bit harsher comment, but when Whitehaven did their deal, I said to the guys in the office, like, whenever BHP does deals, history will show you've been pretty good being on the other side of that deal. So a lot of people are downing Whitehaven at the moment. But
you can throw Rio in, I think, as well.
You can throw. Yeah, I don't want to cast shade on anyone because my brother works at BHP, and so I don't want to dismiss anything that they do. And I'm sure they've got a crack M&A team within BHP, and you know. But you like when I started my career in oil and gas, my career in markets in oil and gas, it was like they just acquired, you know, PetroHawks assets, you know, in the shale field. I think they spent something like $8 billion on those assets, and then they sold them.
Right down.
They completely wrote them down, yeah. Tens of billions of dollars, and then, you know, they sold them on the cheap. And that's just one example. But there's a few examples where BHP haven't been on the right side of some M&A deals, and Stanmore most recently in the coal space, right? Like,
yeah.
Stanmore bought those assets at, you know, one-time spot, and then you've just seen what Stanmore share price has done to see kind of the value that was transferred from BHP to Stanmore. But BHP got the re-rate from the ESG perspective, so maybe everyone wins.
Yeah, so to tie in the China-India thesis, you know, more firmly back into Australia, yeah. My understanding is that you're still pretty bullish Australia.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well, you know, we're not just iron ore, there's the host of battery metals. From a commodities 100%. Point of view, we've got energy and agriculture. Can you sort of expand on your sort of bullish Australia thesis?
I think we're the lucky country. Like, not only do people want to live here,
still.
The quality of life is just so much better than everywhere else in the world. Not absolutely everywhere else in the world, but a lot of other countries in the world. So I think there's still a lot of people that are kind of wanting to come here, whether it be because of the weather and everything else. I do appreciate that our housing prices are a lot higher than some other areas in the world, and that's probably a reflection of people wanting to come here, the desirability of Australia as a place to live. And you're just seeing that in, I guess, the level of immigration that's coming through. I think we're almost double what we were pre-COVID have come through the door in financial year 23. And I think we'll continue to attract those people flows into the country. And as a result, I think you continue to see, you know, the housing market supported somewhat. I mean, higher interest rates are obviously going to cause some issues there, but I think you still can see our country supported. And we are self-sustaining in a lot of commodities, right? Like, not too many countries can boast the level of, you know, commodities in house as to what we have. And as you said, whether it's, you know, iron ore, we supply 2/3 of the world's seaborne iron ore market. We've got, you know, a massive amount of lithium at our doorstep. You know, you look at the amount of the gas that we've got, coal seam gas fields in Queensland, like, we could have the industry to sustain more than just an LNG industry in Queensland. And then agriculture, like, the amount of cattle and the amount of sheep that we've got, like, we are generally self-sustaining. I think there's a lot of countries in the world that could not claim to be as self-sustaining as we are from a commodity standpoint, soft and hard.
So looking at commodities across the board, I think in the the most recent quarterly report from Chester as well, you flashed up the, you know, the chart that all these commodity bulls will always throw up, the S&P 500 versus the Goldman Sachs commodity. Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to sort of dive into this a bit more. It really plays into your sort of interest in real assets and currency debasement. Can you sort of expand upon that for the money miners out there?
Yeah, and again, I'm wandering into numbers that I try and quote numbers, and it's not my skill set to quote numbers. But if you look, the key thing that we're looking at from a macro perspective, because I said it before, I can't pick the macro. I can't tell you, you know, we're going to go into recession and the market's going to do this, because like I said 12 months ago.
I don't think anyone can.
Okay, cool. As long as we've got that point established up front.
I won't hold you to it.
The one thing that we are looking at quite closely, which is hugely material, is the US deficit. So if you look at the US deficit and you look where they ended 30th of June 2023, it was at about $31.5 trillion. So in 2023 financial year, and again, I'm going to misquote numbers 100%, the US spent about $6.5 trillion and they brought in about $4.8 trillion. That's a $1.7 trillion deficit. How do they fund that deficit?
They issue bonds.
They issue bonds, right? And so when there's an increase in supply of bonds and there's not enough demand to take those bonds, the interest rate has to go up. So if you look at the interest that they accrued, so that $6.5 trillion that they spent, that was that included the interest on the $30 trillion worth of bonds that they've previously issued to fund expenditure before 2023. But some of those bonds were struck at a much lower interest rate. Like, you go back pre-COVID and the overnight cash rate was like close to 0%, right? So some of those bonds have really low rates. And so I think the average interest rate, and again, I'm going to misquote, 2.8%, something like that. So they spent, I think it was like $700 billion in interest costs in financial year 23. That's on $30 trillion. You fast forward 4 months from the end of financial year 23 and the deficit spending is higher than the revenue being brought in by $2 trillion. So I know there's some seasonality towards expenditure by the government, But you annualise that, and it's $6 trillion this year after a $1.7 trillion deficit in financial year 23, which is already an alarming number, by the way. You're annualising a $6 trillion deficit in financial year 24 and you're issuing more bonds. Not only that, is the bonds that are in the market are maturing. So something like 47% of US treasuries that are in the market are expiring in the next 3 years. So that 2.7% interest rate, that is going to be marked up. So if you look at bonds at the moment, 5.5% interest rate. So those bonds that are coming off, plus the new bonds that you're issuing to fund that massive deficit at the moment, means the amount that you're spending is getting wider and wider. So if you actually normalised the $700 billion interest expense to 5.5% on $33.5 trillion, which is where the deficit is at now, that's $1.8 trillion that you're spending in just interest alone. And you're only generating $4.8 trillion in revenue at the moment. So it's alarming that it's getting wider and wider. I think there's some theorists in the market that believe the US never has to repay that debt, or at least never has to whittle it down. And I think that's a dangerous thing to believe in. I think that our view is that the only way out of it, and this isn't just, you know, the Fed, this is also like companies, this is also individuals, like the amount of debt that's in the system, the indebtedness of the population, including governments, is just astronomical. And we feel that there's one of two ways you can get rid of the debt, right? You can either write it off and be like Argentina, you don't want to be like Argentina, or financial repression, in which case inflation runs higher than interest. So when inflation runs higher than interest, it inflates the revenue side of the equation. And basically the nominal amount of debt becomes easier to manage because higher levels of inflation means you can kind of like inflate your way out of the debt. Now, they've done it after, I think, World War II, and there's other times in history when they've had to inflate away the debt. So that's kind of one of the strongest theses we have without trying to make too much of a macro call, is that eventually they've got to inflate away some of that debt, which basically means interest rates that are at 5.5% now and inflation that's kind of 4.5%. We kind of feel that inflation will stay higher for longer, but interest rates will have to decrease lower than inflation so you can actually work your way out of some of that debt. Now, what does that mean eventually? The other part of that is when the US needs to keep issuing the debt to fund those deficits, China and Russia are walking away from the bond market, right? Like that's why some of these bonds are maturing. Like, and maybe that's somewhat a function of like the way they weaponized Russia's currency during the start of the Ukraine crisis.
And these have been the buyers for decades.
Right? Yeah. Japan, China, Russia, you know, all the foreign countries, they're stepping away from US debt now. So you've got a situation where foreigners aren't taking on that debt. The US government's deficit's getting wider and wider. They need to fund that deficit. How do you actually fund it? Interest rates have to keep going up. Well, our view is that eventually the Federal Reserve has to be the buyer of last resort. You have to resort back to QE, where the Federal Reserve actually ends up, you know, going back into the market and buying bonds. And when that happens, like, I think it's going to be super, super positive for hard assets. It's going to be super, super positive for gold, because when the market realises there is no way out, anything that's got a fixed level of supply versus the amount of money that has to be created to basically buy those bonds and take them on the Fed's balance sheet, I just think that, or we think that hard assets, you know, like, go up a lot.
And that's the sort of bit that really ties it in for all the money miners who maybe not from a financial background, they might be, you know, geos or mining engineers. The impact that what you just explained there has on real assets, like what we talk about every day, copper, nickel, all these sorts of things, where the supply is fixed and in a lot of cases, you know, fixed to the extent that, you know, you can't really jack it up for quite a lagged period. The price is quite inflationary, right? And that really impacts all the companies that we speak about on a on a daily basis. And I mean, it's a bit broader than that. There's commodities across the complex, not just the hard rock mining assets that we speak about.
Correct.
But the repercussions are felt throughout the whole, you know,
real world. It really is a big factor, and it's probably something we've been thinking about for years. So we're not trying to be alarmist and say this is something that is definitely going to impact your portfolio the next month or two. But at some point, we feel that the US government has to start decreasing interest rates and QE has to be re-engaged the way we see it. Not, you know, we could be wrong. And when that occurs, I would say you want to have some exposure to gold. Like
Okay, so putting aside for a second the potential rise in the gold price,
yep.
Yeah, I think you quote in the quarterly as well that gold equities are looking significantly cheaper, or they're trading at a discount by 60 to 80% sort of percentage to the 2011 peaks. And that's when gold peaked. But since then, you know, I think in nominal terms, we're in the vicinity of where gold was back then. Yep. I think in inflation-adjusted terms, we're a couple hundred bucks below. We have seen, as we touched on earlier in the chat, costs inflate over that period. How do you view the sort of basket of gold equities right now?
So it's a good question. And yeah, you're correct in saying you have to take the costs into the equation. But then you can actually compare golds to what they've historically traded on, either a free cash flow, or probably the easiest one to quote is EBITDA. Now, I know it's not the best proxy, but it's the most available proxy. You can see it quite easily on Bloomberg or Iris. And during the peak of that 2011 bull market cycle, a lot of the golds traded on 8x EBITDA. Now, if you look at Evos and Northern Star as the key big companies in Australia, and I'm not going to quote Newcrest because everything that's going on, there's a few funny things going on there. They trade on either 6 or 7x EBITDA. So you kind of start to still think there's a little bit of upside to get back to where the peak of the last cycle. But I think beyond Northern Star and Evolution, there's a whole bunch of companies in that mid-cap range that just don't receive the same attention for one reason or another. I think a lot of investors don't share the same philosophy that we do around gold and kind of think that, you know, golds have been poor investment decisions previously. And some of these companies, like we'll take Westgold, for example, which is one of our core holdings. We were buying Westgold the back end of last year on the equivalent of like literally 1x EBITDA. Now, EBITDA might not be the best proxy for them given the same business capex that they've got. But, you know, I'll probably underquote again, but it was less than 1.5x EBITDA when we were buying Westgold based on market projections. And we're just like, well, what's your downside? They had $200 million net cash, all in sustaining costs. They were guiding to less than $2,000 an ounce. The gold price was $2,500 an ounce. Unless you thought Wayne and the team was just going to dust a whole bunch of capital, what's your downside in that environment? And the feedback we just kept hearing was, oh, Big Bell has got some challenges and Big Bell's got some challenges and we're worried about the exposure of the company to Big Bell and what it might mean. And you just kind of, we did enough work to satisfy ourselves that Big Bell wasn't, you know, as challenged as what everyone thought. And we kind of watched it for 3 or 4 quarters and what they were delivering from Big Bell kind of was exceeding expectations from a production standpoint. The cost structure was starting to look pretty decent, and every time we'd speak to people that were out there, it was like, well, Big Bell's going quite well. And so then that was kind of an opportunity to go, geez, you know, Northern Star, Evos 5-6x, Westgold on 1x or 1.5x, and even Silver Lake and Ramelius, I think, were on 3x net, you know, EV to EBITDA, and we just kind of went, that's super interesting. So, you know, Westgold is in the mix. We're actually still holding a legacy position in Oceania for a similar reason. We'd always look at Oceania and go, the combination of those assets means it should trade at maybe not the same multiple as an Evolution, but, you know, 1 or 2 EBITDA points behind it. And, you know, since we've been investing in Oceania, it's often traded at kind of 2 to 3x EBITDA versus Evo's at 6x. And we just thought, well, first world jurisdiction and I guess the growth opportunity that might eventually come through for their asset called Wahi in New Zealand might mean that we could see that company being completely undervalued. And it went through a whole bunch of issues with the DPO and, you know, the Philippines, et cetera, and that kind of shunned a lot of people away from the story. But we made a lot of, I guess, we don't normally speak in relative terms at Chester, but when Evos and Northern Stars peaked and then came off quite materially, Oceania actually almost went the other way. So from a relative standpoint, when we're always going to invest 5 to 10% in gold, we believe it was the right call over, you know, that 2021, 2022 period as a, you know, alternative versus those other companies. But at the moment, so Westgold, Genesis, Oceania and Spartan. So we don't often hold 4, but we're Spartan's only a smaller position versus the others. But those are the 4 that we're most excited by. Maybe Spartan and Westgold end up as one of the same eventually. I know we've spoken about this in the past. But, yeah, and each for different reasons, right? I don't want to spend the next, you know, hour talking each of those 4 different stocks, but each of those we first and foremost from those, you know, tenants that we speak to, we can see the valuation upside in each of them as a starting point, but then either the quality of the management team, the quality of the resource, or just the opportunity within them, we can still see upside for all 4 of them.
There we go, mate. Part 1, macro, the investing style, it's all there. And I can't wait to share part 2. We're going to get into the consolidation that we're seeing across various commodities, across various regions, and all the stocks that people want to hear about.
I'm absolutely pumped. G, JD, absolutely pumped. I think we're going to upload part two tomorrow. Go back to back because I know everyone's going to be itching for it. I teased something in the intro of this one that doesn't actually come out until the next one.
You did.
Just for the hook.
And before we round out, Tuesday night in Sydney, Criterion Hotel, we're going to be there. Come
tomorrow
down.
Night. Shit.
Have a chat. Let's do it.
All right. Thanks to our partners, Future Proof at the top of the show, KCA, Terra Capital, JP Search, K-Drill, SMEC. Have I missed one?
Anytime Exploration
Anytime
Services.
Anytime Exploration.
Wicked. Beautiful. Thanks a bunch, guys.
Hooteroo.
Hooteroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.